today. We have a brand new committee, and this is our maiden meeting, and so we're breaking new ground. And I want to welcome all of you here to our new Workforce Advocacy and Access Committee. It's kind of a mouthful, but we have a lot of work to do, and I'm very happy to have the opportunity to be on this committee because I think it's a direction that the regions have wanted to move in, and this gives us an opportunity to formalize that. Before I begin, I would like to just commend these two outstanding women on either side of me, Melanie Heath and Carrie Main. They have been very busy. I just found out about this committee a week ago. I don't think on July 1 was, I mean, this wasn't even on the, so they have been very, very busy, and I just want to recognize both of them for the exceptional work they've done already in just 3 weeks around the clock, and how lucky we are to have them as our resource team as we move forward. Many of you know that Carrie came from Workforce Services, and Dr. Riley, who singled you out the other day is saying, I hate to, Senator Miller said, hey, I hate to be quoting these with Carrie in the room. So, Melanie, we've had a much longer opportunity to get to know the great work she's done with all of our communications. So anyway, we are well staffed, and I want to thank them very much. This is an interesting effort for us to move forward to. Dr. Riley, when he was talking about our board responsibilities, he singled out two things. One, our responsibility to the students to guarantee what kind of experience they have, and then our responsibility to advocate for the system. And so that falls clearly right into here. And oh, I brought a couple of newspapers. Just this week, I hope many of you have already seen them. I thought I had them. This was the headline in the Deseret News. Mm-hmm. But the real headline to me was, can higher ed be fixed? And then I hope all of you saw the commissioner's op-ed mm-hmm. piece in Wednesday's about the opportunity gap. So there is a lot of interest, and I thought this was a good introduction to our first meeting today. So with that, let's go ahead and focus on, we don't have a formal agenda for you, but yet we do have like other committees, we'd normally be reporting on what we've done. So we're kind of starting and moving forward, but we have our charge, and we know what we have to do to look at workforce needs, access, and advocacy for the system. So the first item, and this is all in your tab K, is the study that was presented this morning, Utah's Growing Opportunity Gap. And I'm going to just turn the time over to Carrie to lead this discussion, since she's been working so hard on this, and then we'll have a chance for comments in a few minutes.
I will dive into a presentation. Yeah. Before I do, I think we should thank Jessalie for chairing this committee. Melanie and I have visioned this out, and we were so excited when we heard that you were willing to be the chair. And so
thank you.
We're going to really flourish under your leadership, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
So I'm going to go into a bit more detail on what I touched on in the committee of the whole this morning. For a couple of reasons, I think this is a group of people who need to understand the nuances of the data that built that conclusion that I presented, and also just to create a relationship with you all so that you know I and my staff and others in USHI are willing to dig out whatever data we can to help really inform policy the phrase data-driven gets thrown around a lot, and sometimes people make a decision and then they like pretty it up with some data, and you look at it and say, this, I don't see the cause and effect relationship here, but I'm going to ensure that we really do focus on getting data that drives a logical policy. So I'm setting the stage for this relationship with you all. What we started with, as I said this morning, was looking at the projections on the state's population that were produced by the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. Here are the overarching aggregate numbers that led to the percentages that I presented. So in 2018, the total population was estimated to be about 2.38 million. Of that, 476,000 is our minority population. In 2025, our population is expected to hit just under 3.8 million, with almost 1.3 million being a minority population. So we go from one-fifth minority to over one-third minority population. So those are the details underneath what was presented there. And as I said, what's most important is to realize that in that year, we're going to see our growth come equally from our minority and from our non-minority populations. I loved Pam Perlick's summary statement in her write-up of this data. She said, this is the new Utah. It's a simple statement, but I think it says it all. It really is a new Utah, and we need to ensure, as a Board of Regents, that we are developing policy that is shaped by this new picture of Utah. The commissioner's op-ed, as Jessely showed us all, I was very excited when I found out from Melanie that Commissioner Wolstenholme was going to really just present himself to the Utah public on this issue. It shows that we are on top of it, and I think as a committee here, we are going to be the ones that will advise Commissioner Wolstenholme on where we need to go to address this issue. I want to get into really how we built that 290,000 number. And this is where I'm showing you what sort of data we have. Many of you are probably familiar with it, but I want to build that deeper understanding so you can explore other ways to put the data together and advise us on what sort of data we can provide for you. So we looked at current enrollment rates. So we looked at 18 to 35-year-old population numbers from the Kem C. Gardner Institute and from the Census Bureau. We understand how many people fit into that age group. Then we look at how many of those 18 to 35-year-olds are enrolled in a USHE institution. So for the white population in that age group in 2018, 15.1% were enrolled. So now we want to compare groups. Our Hispanic population is 9.6% enrollment. Asian population is closer at 13.2%. The Black population at 13.0%. Hawaiian Pacific Islander, I apologize for the small font, 9.1%. Native American population, just under 10% enrollment. And those who reported two or more races, just slightly under parity with the white population at 14.8%. So these are current enrollment gaps. This is what we built off of. So we start with that detailed population project. We start with Kem C. Gardner Institute's detailed population projections. So not only do they give a summary number, as I started with, but they have this data parsed out by age groups, by gender, by ethnicity. So we know, for example, what the projection is for Hispanic males, Hispanic females in that 18 to 35-year-old group. We apply this enrollment rate to that projected population growth, is essentially what we're doing. That is the analysis that we're doing. And it's a naive analysis because we're assuming there's no effect, that what happens today will continue to happen. That's probably not the case, but it is a good place from which we start. And that's where we need to build policies based on what is going on today. So we'll take what's going on today, let's assume nothing happens, nothing changes, and what would 2065 look like? So we're saying, taking these enrollment numbers and the completion numbers and basically pulling them through the population projections. But then we're going to compare it to a supposition that we can somehow reach parity, that all students of any racial or ethnic background would be completing at the same rates. And we'll use the predominant race ethnicity group, the white group, as our place. So the difference between those two are that what we're saying are those foregone certificates and awards. I've only presented the enrollment data to you now. We need the completion data to close the story. So, before we get to the completion, the enrollment projections. So when we look at what enrollment would look like in 2065, just for 2065 alone, for that year, we would have a gap of enrollment of 23,000 Hispanic students. So that's how many more we would need to have to see the Hispanic students enrolling at the same rate as the white students. For Asians, 1,800, Black students, 1,300, Hawaiian Pacific Islanders, 1,200, Native Americans, 800, and then those of two or more race categories, 1,000. So that's where it would look in the enrollment side. So then you take those enrollment numbers to then also look at completion numbers.
Can I just say that's really doable, though? Those are great numbers. Those are not millions. Those are not tens of thousands, except for one.
Exactly, exactly.
That's a really doable,
it is.
Issue.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to be made, is that this isn't an overwhelming problem.
But that only brings us to the level where the whites are now. That's not saying that that's where we want to end up being. Right.
That's a good point, too. So what if we want to enroll at higher level, at higher rates, we're already behind in terms of our minority population. That, too, is a great point that we need to keep in mind. Okay. So completion rates, the disparities in completion rates. So take the same age group and compare completions of those enrolled students to our white completion rate. For the white students, 32.1% are completing in that age category of the enrolled students. Hispanics have a completion rate of 22.1%. The Asian population is just a smidge behind the white population at 31%. The Black population is almost 10% behind. Hawaiian Pacific Islanders are just over 20%. Our Native American population completing at a rate of 23.5%, and the individuals reporting two or more races are slightly ahead of our white population in terms of completion. Any questions on those? Yes.
So obviously this says the percentage of those who are completing. If I had another bar graph, it would show a percentage of, let's say, 68% of that white population is not graduating. Is that correct?
Yes. The tricky thing about all this is we have complex inflows and outflows of students. So we're having to make data decisions that maybe don't completely encompass all of the reality of students flowing in and out of our education system. One of the big things here is that we're only looking at 18 to 35 year olds.
So for example, let's say a student starts at the U and they finish at Weber State. Do we know that?
Yes.
We do know that.
Yes, so the all eight institutions are feeding all of their data up to us. And so we would see that person as a completion at Weber.
Okay.
But so do you see it as an incompletion at the U?
No, it's not an incompletion at the U.
So just an aside, I think what worries me even more about the gap is we have so many students who aren't graduating.
Regardless of ethnicity,
we have got a big problem, a huge gap in getting people through the system with some sort of a certificate, a diploma of some sort. Mm-hmm. We're wasting resources for them and for us.
I think that was the point that Marlon was making also, is that that we need to be thinking about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the 15% or the 32% is what white students are completing, the rate at which they're completing, but that is a low rate.
Actually, I was having a conversation with Preston Cook yesterday, and that was about how do we take people to completion regardless of race or ethnicity? Also, the other thing is the workforce that you, when you are looking at young people, I see Dixie advertising in Cedar City. Why is there is a rural population that we have? How do we do outreach to the rural population? Because those young people also need the hope and growth into the new world, new workplace that we are talking about, the more educated workforce. Mm-hmm. And it does worry me that only 32% of the majority population is completing. And, you know, yes, we do need emphasis on the other races, the minorities, but as a state in entirety, we should be focusing on everybody, not just the disparity between the minority and the majority.
It's everybody.
But I think it fits into our workforce goal, because the access is more toward the minority issue, and maybe poverty, and maybe some other groups that I want to talk about, non-traditional students. But the completion rate is so that we can provide a group to the workforce.
Yes.
I think our committee can do both of those things. I don't feel like they're either or.
I just wanted to say the U's holding a national completion summit to this point about what moves the needle in late September, and we're bringing in people from around the country to talk about exactly this issue. I mean, there are best practices that do make a difference. I'm a newcomer, so I can't take credit for this, but, you know, the U's graduate completion rate has gone up dramatically in the last few years, and there are reasons for that, right? Just, and that's sort of what are the best practices and how do we apply those across the system, and that's what this completion summit's going to talk about is, you know, what are the things that make a difference for different groups of students and what can help them succeed.
I would also understand why two or more completion rate is better than the majority. Well, it is better than overall.
I've wondered that as well. I've been parsing the data to try and understand that population, and I'm not sure what that is.
Well, it might not be statistically significant.
It is a smaller group.
Yeah.
It's a smaller group. But it does stay steady over time, so.
Yep.
This is the 6-year graduation, or 8?
I believe that's what
6-year.
Miss? Is it Melanie?
Carrie. That's Melanie.
Melanie. Carrie.
Some time ago, I did a study the governor asked me to participate in about young women and graduation rates, and it's quite low in the state of Utah for a number of factors. But in some ways, we would not want to forget that gender relative to graduation as well. Although I'm not treated as a minority in here, but it cannot be overlooked. I think it's fundamental for us that we need to make sure the young women get the education they desire in their lives. And as a sort of a committee, we want to make sure we're addressing that.
Okay, that's good. We will definitely note that. So the net results, we've discussed this estimate of foregoing 290,000 degrees and certificates by 2065 without an intervention, should things stay the same. What that means as far as rates over annual progression, the completion rate would be showing a decrease of 0.1% every year, and the enrollment rate would show a decreasing rate, a rate of decrease of 1.6% per year. So we would be losing those gains that we have been seeing over the last 10 years or so. And I love that you have already been making the workforce connection. Did you?
Well, I'm thinking this number is tied to the gap on minorities. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say it that way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
If we looked at another stat, it would be those who don't graduate as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're talking like a million degrees of people.
This is
a bigger gap
just,
in the workforce issue.
This is just keeping up with that the completion rate of the white.
Yep.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Again, the fact that you've made the workforce connection with my background in workforce, the first thing I go to is what does this mean? What does this mean for the economy? And I think these are really telling numbers. This is what I've always focused on is the the education pays story, and people talk about, well, incomes rise. I used to always try and make the point, well, not only does your income rise, but you're less likely to become unemployed at any point in your life the higher your education level is. In fact, just getting from less than high school, someone without a high school degree, to getting some college, even an associate's degree, is going to cut your unemployment rate in half. And then our bachelor's degree, in Utah, those with a bachelor's degree or higher have an unemployment rate of 2%. That's more than full employment. It's amazing. So that, I think, is something that we need to be keeping in the back of our minds. But I think these are statistics that probably are even less well known, and that is that we have differences in the unemployment rate by race and ethnicity in our state and in any state. If you look just at our white population, the unemployment rate in 2017 was 4.1%, but for our Black or African American population, it was 7.2%. American Indian, Alaskan Native, 12.5%. Asians had an equal unemployment rate. Native Hawaiians and other Pacific Islanders are 8.9%. Some other race that isn't in the census categories, the unemployment rate is 5.3%. Those who report two or more races, unemployment rate of 6.5%. Those who reported ethnicity of Hispanic or Latino origin with any race category, so these are a separate data question, 5.4%. And then the white alone, that specific group that's not reporting the ethnicity of Hispanic or Latino, unemployment rate of 4%. So this is the workforce outcome of having those completion rates that are below. So to me, these things are all correlated in an important way that we need to be thinking about. Sencha.
One comment on that, when I look at the unemployment rate and look at it from an employer's perspective, these are correlated. However, the unemployment rate is more, it's a different topic from my perspective, and that would be educating the educated or either graduated with high school, doesn't matter. Educating them to be ready for workplace. Getting a piece of paper that gives you a certificate, a degree, or a high school diploma does not make you eligible for workplace in the long term. You know, you get a job. Can you last in that job? Do you have the ability to work within the group? Do you have the social skills?
Soft skills.
Job skills. And that is slightly different from getting somebody to graduate.
But that's something that perhaps as a committee we can be talking about. What role could the system play in perhaps developing or embedding that sort of soft skill training into a student's post-secondary experience?
Yeah, I was just going to add that we have those board-approved high-impact practices, which include things like internship, study abroad, those skills that really do translate into workforce. So I think we are kind of starting that, all the institutions have been doing it, but we're doing it in a more systematic way already. So hoping that might help, especially if we're putting them throughout the curriculum.
You know, sometimes we get people walk in for an interview, they don't even have proper clothes on. Mm-hmm. You know, one really articulate guy walks in wearing a pair of jeans, you know, the ones where it shows like the underwear is showing on the back. How do you, I mean, that's an example, extreme example of that. But that contributes towards that unemployment rate because they don't have a role model that they can aspire to be.
Yeah, agreed. I think these are lots of great topics we can also take into our workforce discussion. So I appreciate you mentioning
just
that.
One other thing, I mean, unemployment rate is a part of the story, but it's not all of the story because there's the employment level. You have low unemployment and have people underemployed where their skills are not matched to the available job. So there's both sides of that. How do we get people engaged in education, but also how do we match them to opportunities that not only exist now, 2065 is a long time, right? So the world's going to be what? I don't know what it's going to look like in 2065, but I'm confident it won't look like now. And so that's the other aspect I think is important in this.
Yeah, these are important topics. I appreciate you guys are connected together. So we're sharing this data, and you guys are, have got these amazing ideas around it, and I hope you continue to digest ideas and maybe come up with other data you might want to see. But one way we've already in our office been applying this data is the scholarship question, as was raised in the committee of the whole. And here's just a couple of ways that we've been parsing out the data to take a look at how these numbers could influence what we do with our state scholarships. This is two different ways to look at the data on our scholarships. Just a couple of examples. Over here on the left, the orange table is, we're looking at the share of the graduates within each of those categories that received a region scholarship. For example, that's one of our state scholarships. So of the population of white students who graduated in the 2017-2018 school year, 11.7% of those students received a region scholarship. Of the graduating minorities in 2018, only 4% of those students received a region scholarship. So that's taking this data, this demographic data, and sort of then taking it down into the, stepping a little closer to policy. Another way to look at it instead is to take a look at all of those who received a region scholarship and see how it shares out between the two groups. So if you look at all of the students who received a Regent scholarship, 91% of the recipients were white and 9% were minority students. Yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah. Right. So
just so one of the interventions is looking at aid and that barrier of financial. Is that right?
One of the
interventions for the opportunity to close the opportunity gap we're talking about is going to be state aid.
I think so. I think.
I mean, is that what?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the purpose of the task force, the scholarship task force that we're putting together, is to kind of take a hard look at this data and use the data to inform, you know, next steps on what we should do as a state around state aid and how we prioritize those dollars.
And part of that has to do with what classes they're taking and getting them, the school counselors, getting them to take the right classes so that they qualify. You know, mm-hmm. Which I know the scholarships are changing, but so the aid is just part of the story. The other part is preparation and the track mm-hmm. that they're on.
Yeah.
Can I put a comment on that, building on what Tammy said? I was writing down exactly what you just said. So we do have this counselor program that we are rolling out, but the number of students in proportion to the number of counselors that is available, mm-hmm. there is a big disparity. Mm-hmm. You're asking the counselors to guide them through graduation, through college prep, mm-hmm. and through scholarship prep. I don't know if a counselor has the time given the large student population that they have. One thing I wanted to ask, last year in the same meeting we had talked about sending out postcards to students about you have admission, or here mm-hmm. are the things that are available to you. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever got a feedback on whether it was implemented. Did we do anything with it this year?
Yeah.
How do we do social media postings?
Right.
How do we inform students? And so, these are low cost.
Right.
This would probably be a good time for update. I had the same question.
Sure.
Melanie.
So our office looked at the data around. So what she's talking about is there is a project we were looking at doing last year that would essentially send a quote-unquote acceptance letter to every high school graduate in the state saying that you've been accepted, all you have to do now is apply. As we looked at, we worked with the State Board of Ed or their office, and as we looked at them, the data around that is pretty complicated. We weren't able to get the data we needed for that project, and we felt like our resources were really better spent on this College Access Advising Initiative, because the questions that letter was trying to answer are much better answered by a person on the ground in the high school. who can direct them to what their college opportunities are, how to fill out the FAFSA, direct them through college applications, connect them to scholarships, those sorts of things. So we kind of took a step back from that. I also know it was implemented in Idaho, and there was some initial success, but then in looking at the data, I think it actually caused a bit of confusion for students because they thought they were accepted instead of realizing they had a next step where they actually still had to apply. So I do think, and we'll talk about this a little bit when I talk about the College Access Advisor expansion, but I do think that moving forward, a huge portion of our outreach activities in the office are going to be done through this new network of advisors. And having someone on the ground is going to be much more, I think it's going to be really much more helpful to having students guide them through those conversations.
One thing that you may want to consider mm-hmm. is the use of social media.
Uh-huh.
The cost is low. Students do, if you look at young people today, mm-hmm. do they ever read a piece of paper? To them, a piece of paper is, oh, that's so mom and dad,
mm-hmm.
right? But all of them have their phone in their hand.
Mm-hmm.
And heaven forbid anything posts on their Facebook or on their Twitter or
mm-hmm.
in their text message, it's like, oh, I got a check.
Mm-hmm.
My phone buzzed.
Right.
I see this in my house. I'm sure when you look at children in your families, it is the same thing. How do we utilize that, a lower cost method of reaching out? Hey, if you complete with this much GPA,
mm-hmm.
You have a chance of getting a scholarship. If you complete these courses, you have a chance. And a sequence of these that you can automatically trigger. I think there are companies in Utah that do that, but that is at a cost. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are things we can do with engagement with different universities. These can be projects that university students can implement
mm-hmm.
as their graduate programs or their undergrad.
We also have great resources at UPIA. You guys know about the UPIA FAFSA workshops.
Right.
I mean, UPIA does a ton of outreach with getting kids and their families to complete FAFSA. So
yeah.
I just want to say a big picture thing. It feels to me like as a committee, we're going to have to come up with better use of existing resources, repurposing things like scholarships that are already in place and
mm-hmm.
they don't take new money.
Mm-hmm.
And then a smaller part of our answers have to be new money and new programs. So I feel like we've got some work to do as a committee in having, you know, the guy from UPIA come to us and say what they're already doing on FAFSA, and then we can use that as part of our build on that, like you're saying, but use it as part of our recommendations so that we don't come back to the Regents with this big menu of things that don't ever get followed up on. And I'm sure you guys have it scoped that way, but I just needed to say it out loud because there's so many things here that we could address. And
yeah, absolutely.
I feel like we're going to have to do mm-hmm. some of them as, hey, here's stuff that's already working. Here's stuff we could do better.
Good point.
Great, that's smart. Yeah.
Actually, I just was talking to Dave from
Biosyn.
Yeah, and he said that students don't even finish FAFSA.
Mm-hmm.
FAFSA.
FAFSA. Yeah.
But
it's
acronym.
It's difficult to fill out.
Yeah, it is. It's very
daunting. I hated filling out.
I
was my
son. It was hard. It was torture. It wasn't difficult. It was torture.
Yeah.
I mean, 3 years of dancing.
And I knew they weren't going to qualify.
Really?
But,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was just
pure
torture.
Oh, I was. Oh,
yeah,
so
we can do the customer.
So we need to make an action item of this, and as you saw in your packet, basically accept the commissioner's recommendation to turn it over to staff to really do a deep dive and report back to us. So I'd be happy to entertain a motion to make that action. Thanks,
so,
Seth.
Let's go through the plan on things that we would like to, I was stating it in my words the way you wanted it. Do the research so that we can propose to the company in general what our goals should be.
Perfect. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Good. Any further discussion?
Just a question. I would love to be involved as you go through the thought process of the region to maybe just give some input. I mean, that's the world I live in, and so I understand some of the issues you might deal with. But I would love to sit with you and go through the process, or it's appropriate.
Good. Well, and so all in favor of supporting sending this to the staff for further study, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Good. You've got your work cut out. This is probably also a good time to remind everyone it was presented this morning, but on the off months, like when we have a Board of Regents meeting, we'll have this committee, but in the off months, then we will meet as a committee, and that's set up for the second Wednesday morning at the commissioner's office.
We'll be in touch.
But this will give us really a chance to have more of a time for this kind of dialogue, and so I think that'll be really important as we go forward. The next.
Can I just say one thing?
You bet.
And I think this reflects some of the other concerns. So we definitely want to address the minority access issue. But my issue is broader in the sense of special groups like adult learners or women returning to school or, you know, what you're talking about.
There's lots of segments.
Right, there's some other segments. So my pet one is foster kids. There's only 2,300 foster kids at any one time in the state, and there's about 4,000 to 5,000 if you take all the ones served during a year. So that doesn't add a ton to our workload, but their college enrollment rate is like 0.6 or something. And I have, when I was at Human Services, we already had a lot done on it, so I can send it to you guys, and I have ideas on it. But is it appropriate that we can add other things besides that to the access piece, or do you guys just want to stick with the minority access piece for now? Because I don't want to overwhelm you.
I think that's up to the committee. I mean, I think one thing that's important is that we do remain focused, because I don't want us to get spread too thin. But I do think we can.
I mean, I think as long as I think the thing that would make sense is for us to continue to be outcome oriented, but then to move on to the next. So if we have a running list of groups that we want to address, I think that would make sense to know that, okay, right now our priority, based on what we've already done with the analysis, would be for the racial and ethnic minorities. But we know that coming up, we want to then turn to perhaps other populations like foster children, and you're providing your data would help a lot.
Right, but wouldn't they be included in this data anyway?
I mean, they might be. I think you could say they're going to be spread all over, so it's not really going to target them. Yeah. But the issues are going to be structurally different for them because of the lack of a parent involvement.
Right.
But there is already a scholarship that's going to come up in your review, the Only Walker Transition to Adult Living Scholarship, which goes to a foster child every year. And so
Child?
Is it just
no, there's a couple. It depends. We honestly don't have enough kids applying for it every year, so it never gets exhausted.
I don't think that flows through our office.
And I was going to say,
it goes through the 529 plan, so I know it goes through the general higher ed system.
There are some states who are, they just give free tuition to foster kids that have been in the foster system, and that's becoming more and more. I can't remember which state just did it last week. But that's becoming very.
So all I'm saying is, it would, the kids might be there as individuals, but they might not have their needs addressed by a racial and ethnic minority approach. So I would still want it on the bulletin board for when we get to it.
It's that intersecting.
And then, there's an intersection.
Good.
And then there would be able to develop a thousand.
No, but the good news is, when I was on the UPA board and Dave Feitz was reporting on all the staffs at workshops, I said, have you guys ever taken it to the Foster Care Foundation? Because that's the central place where all foster parents get trained in the state. And he started going to the Foster Care Foundation with his, you know, standard deal. He didn't do anything special. He just sent his people there. And they started training foster parents, and foster parents started filling out FAFSAs for their non-kids, their
that's
foster
great.
Kids. So that's simple kind of things like that. You just ask the question and you reconnect two different groups that weren't connected. And Foster Care Foundation was so happy to get FAFSA expertise, and Fights was so happy to get his numbers up. So it was like, yay. So anyway,
well,
I feel
thank
like there's
you.
Pluses to that. We can just identify the issues. It's not like I have to build it from the ground.
So we really had two options, both within the scholarship committee and then certainly within ours, mm-hmm. to be aware of that. The next item is an information item, and I thought that we thought it would just be a great time to go through really an overview of our committee. I know that Melanie did a brief one this morning, but I'm going to turn the time over to Melanie now to just an overall review of where our committee hopes to go.
Sure. So this, I think, is tab L in your agenda. There's a brief one-page memo on top, and then there's the attachment at the end. That's a two-page overview of what we're hoping to do with this committee. I think I also sent it to Regents beforehand. So I'm going to go through this fairly quickly because I think most of y'all have seen it. But if you have any questions, feel free to stop me, and it's all up for discussion. I just want to make sure that we're starting from the same foundation with which we want to build this committee's work. So as I talked about a little bit in the Committee of the Whole, when we were looking at the committees that the board is currently made up of, they're really internal institutional facing committees. And we felt like it was really important to capture the work we're doing in the access realm, both with the State Board of Ed and other populations as they're coming into higher ed, and then capturing them as they leave and how they're connecting to the workforce. Both of those populations are also the most external facing, so this is also the natural committee to do advocacy work through. With that, we hope to engage a lot of external stakeholders like the State Board of Ed, like workforce partners like Talent Ready Utah and others, to really kind of understand and work together at a state level on these issues. So we put together a little committee purpose. I'll just read it. So our committee will provide Utahns, especially those from underserved populations, the opportunity to recognize the value of higher ed, enter college, and connect with meaningful employment upon graduation. So there's a couple of ways that we're hoping to do this. So we want to work to make the transition from high school to college really simple and seamless. We want to identify and align workforce and economic development efforts statewide, and then we want to advocate for higher ed throughout the state. So, you know, just those tiny projects to work on. We want to do this by strengthening partnerships with state and community partners and using data to inform decision-making and goal-setting, and be really laser-focused on outcomes of initiatives and efforts. Success looks like we're working on setting goals, but we want to increase the college participation rate of high school grads by 6% by 2025. We want to tie USHE graduate outcomes with workforce demand, and then we want to increase the public perception of the value of higher ed. We are working with a agency who's going to do a benchmarking survey for us so that we understand what the current perception of higher ed is now in Utah, and then we'll use that to do some really explicit outcome setting. So kind of working through this, we've identified a few things that we anticipate this committee to be really focused on, one of which is, I'm hoping you all saw in your board packet, but we are hosting a K-20 summit on November 14th. We're hoping that's going to be, or it's really, it's going to be a state-level, board-level conversation about this transition space from high school to college. So we're going to have the State Board of Ed, the State Superintendent, the Commissioners, the UTEC Board of Trustees, the Board of Regents, and the Governor's Office really included in what does this transition space look like? How do our boards kind of navigate that space, and what are some key issues that we need to work on as a state? I have a steering committee put together with representatives from each of those entities, and the few topics we've aligned on is concurrent enrollment. So the role of concurrent enrollment, how can we make sure concurrent enrollment is accessible? We know that enrollment gaps between racial populations exist in concurrent enrollment course taking, so what are some policy levers we can work on to ensure that there's parity there. And then we're also really want to focus on the access piece too. How are students understanding what options are available to them for college? How are we communicating that? The College Access Advising Initiative, how is that going to work? Along with the state scholarship conversation. So that's going to be a pretty crucial piece. And then, let's see. We also are hoping to use this committee to advise on and engage in a multi-year higher ed advocacy campaign. So one piece of that this year, we're really laying the groundwork for what that looks like. We're wanting to do this benchmarking survey. For the first time, all of our institutions have a joint editorial calendar that we're all working off of with key themes for each season. So we're hoping that that will really amplify messaging across institutions. Everyone's also, or a large majority, are also using this new tool called Merit Pages, which is a really, I'm happy to walk any of y'all through it, but it's this really cool and integrated way to use social media to encourage organic sharing of positive college stories. And so I think we have about 6 institutions that are signing on to that, so that's going to be a really great partnership there. And then, Carrie, I don't know if you want to talk a bit about the aligning system output, regional market demand.
So one other role that this committee will play is finding ways in which we can ensure that the efforts being put forward by the regents and by the USHE system align with the different efforts around the state. This is something I talked about earlier in the committee of the whole, the different efforts around the state having to do with workforce development. Blair and I both, you all know Blair Carruth from the USHE office, we are involved in several different groups along with Commissioner Wolston, whom, where workforce development is the primary focus. And we want to ensure that whatever the regents see as the path forward for ensuring that students get lucrative careers that help them to pay off their tuition, and we want to ensure that that message is taken to those committees. So we think this is where the groundwork discussions will happen, that we can then, the visions that we have and the ideas we have, we can take over to the committee of the whole, and then Blair and I, along with Commissioner Wolston, whom will ensure that our alignment is in that direction.
And then last, we have a few fiscal year 2020, hopefully, committee outcomes that we can all shoot for. So in the access arena, it's really helping to inform the direction of the state scholarship programs. We want to work to expand the College Access Advising Program, which I'll chat about in a second. And then we really want to talk about concurrent enrollment growth outreach and these gaps in enrollment for concurrent enrollment and how we can address them. We're also interested in looking at really a K through 12 outreach strategy and what that looks like using our partners at the institution level and also our different divisions in the office. And then for advocacy, we're really hoping to lay some groundwork for this campaign for next year using this committee. So that looks like message development, stakeholder engagement, and then having some review and insights on this benchmarking survey that we should complete by calendar year end. And Carrie, do you want to touch on the workforce pieces?
So our workforce goals are to, one of the things we'd be doing, and this is going to the committee of the whole today, but yeah, in the future it would be discussed here, will be the non-credit CTE programs. That definitely has an important workforce component. Those non-credit CTE programs have opportunities for scholarship money, am I correct, Blair? And that, but one of the charges that the institutions have in identifying those is to ensure that they're aligned with workforce demand. So that will be an opportunity for us to have our workforce vision touching the school programs for those CTE non-credit. So that will be one, like, on-the-ground implementation of our vision on workforce.
Great. So that's just kind of an overview of the work of the committee, and it's an informational item only, so we don't require any action. The next thing is we would like to have an update on the College Access Advising Program, and that's tab M in your material, and we'll turn it over to Melanie again for that.
I know we're a little short on time, so I'll do this fairly quickly, but we're very excited. So if you remember, I think it was in September of last year, the Board of Regents voted to approve a statewide expansion of the College Access Advising Program, which would place a recent college graduate permanently in every high school in the state. That person, the College Access Advisor, would help students on the milestones to college. So specifically registering for and preparing for college entrance exams, helping them complete college applications, connecting them to financial aid opportunities, including the FAFSA and scholarships, and then connecting them to their receiving institution for first-year experience programs. We know that historically, so this program's been around, run through the U, for about 12 years, and they've been in 12 high schools in those 12 years, and the data around it is really compelling. So we know that for every, if a student meets with a college access advisor at least three times, they're almost twice as likely to go to college. We also know that this is especially meaningful for first-generation students. The data increases from there. We also know that as a whole, the high school participation rate in college from the schools it's been in has increased about 9% over the 12 years that the program has been in those schools. So this year, we're expanding in the first phase, so that we will increase from 12 high schools to 34 across the state. They're located in regional clusters, so there's a Weber-Davis cluster, Salt Lake County cluster, Utah County cluster, and Washington County cluster. Hallelujah, all the advisors have been hired as of yesterday. Very excited about that. We also have hired a mid-level supervisor who will be supervising about 8 to 12 of these advisors. And that person is a system employee, but they're actually housed at the institution in their region. And so the advisors themselves do roll over every 1 to 3 years to keep that kind of recent college graduate experience fresh. The regional coordinator is a permanent 12-month employee who we're hoping can really align institution efforts in that region through this program. They can connect with the community in really meaningful ways to make sure that those relationships stay intact as the advisor rolls over. And I think you can read a little bit more about that, but we're really excited about this. It's been a huge project, and I think it's really going to be meaningful. We're excited to host all of the advisors next week at our offices to train them. And then the following week, we're loading up, I think, 7 or 8 minivans. Everyone is doing a statewide road trip to all of the USU campuses, including USU Eastern, and the privates, to connect the advisors to admissions folks at those institutions and to make sure that they have a good understanding of the campus feel so that they're prepared to talk to students about that. One thing that's not in here but I think is really interesting is the database that's behind this is going to give us really, really robust data about these the meetings that the advisor is actually having with students. So it keeps track of how many times you're meeting one-on-one with each of your students, the advisor's meeting one-on-one, how many times and how often you're engaging parents and families in those discussions, how many scholarships they've applied for, how many they've received, how many college applications they've applied for, where they got into, if they've completed their FAFSA. And a new thing this year that we're really excited about is there's actually a college match component, so it looks at the student's GPA ACT score and then where they've been accepted to college. So it's a way that we can, and where they've applied, so that we can really understand if the students are being advised correctly about what kind of college opportunities best suits them. So very exciting. I think this is going to be a hugely impactful thing for our state.
I know that in my own mind, I just thought, can you imagine having someone in the high school that's actually been to every single campus and can speak firsthand to that experience? I mean, I think that is huge. Mm-hmm. And to think that we have that in 34 schools, what a great beginning of getting this ultimately within the next 2 years in every high school. So I think we all can feel very proud and thanks to all of you. And I'm glad they're all hired because school starts. So that's great. So again,
So this is phase one of the expansion. We're going forward with a legislative request for $3 million, which will fund phase two, which would mean that in fall 2020, we would hire an additional 60 advisors. So we'd be in 94 high schools next fall. And then we're going back to legislature the next year for an additional $3 million so that we would be in every high school by fall 2021. So.
And I hope that we can organize each one of these these 34 schools to get those kids to contact their legislators
yes.
and tell them how that's made that experience so much mm-hmm. better. But again, an informational item which we'll be hearing more about as we go on. And we had hoped to have some time, 20 minutes for discussion. We do have a few minutes to just talk about workforce and the system, kind of an overall. And I'm going to turn that over to Carrie to kind of lead that discussion in the few minutes we have remaining.
So I wanted to use you all as a resource. I was brought to the Utah System of Higher Education to work on workforce, and it has been worked on, and there are efforts, but I want to know from you all, what do you think we can do as a system, at the system level, to ensure that higher education is a valuable tool to grow our economy? There are a lot of efforts throughout the state with workforce services and Governor's Office of Economic Development, but what direction do you think we can go in? What can we do to affect unemployment, wages, labor force participation? What do you think we as a system can do? What policies can we put in place, or how can we direct funds, energy, effort in a meaningful way so that when the governor says that the unemployment rate for this month is 2.8%, he turns and says thank you to the Utah System of Higher Education for ensuring that our students are part of a meaningful workforce.
I think we should count on Tammy. When the governor says that we have an educated workforce, I think he should call out the Utah System. He is very proud of saying that we have a very educated and very engaged workforce. So how about getting him to give us a kudos for that?
Oh, he does. I don't know when he ever has not. He's very proud of that,
yeah.
And he's proud of our low tuition, the lowest right. in the country, mm-hmm. The number of students that we have that move on from the high school right into higher ed. So, yeah, he's
just at that higher.
Oh, okay. All right. In fact, she's been bragging about the U.S. News and World Report the last couple of years, mm-hmm. Ranking us number 3 in the country, and it's the higher ed system that's ranked the highest. The higher ed system's been what's bringing that ranking up. We dropped to 10, but that was, I think, because of preschool calculations that they put in there. So, but yeah, no, fantastic. The governor's very, very supportive. He'll be with you in November celebrating the 50th anniversary of higher education. So I'll make sure he gives you the shout out.
Well, this is probably more a data request, and I'll send it to you guys. But I do feel like there's a part of it that's not as linear as clean, maybe. But when I was at head of human services, you know, $700 million annual budget, and the legislature always like, cut your budget, build roads, whatever. And I would say, I'm a Republican, guys, I'll cut the budget, but you gotta let me repurpose the savings. And what you could do, and there is data about this, is you can say that if you educate kids,
yeah.
that are disadvantaged already because they're in human services, they're in my delinquency programs or my kids with disabilities programs or my foster care programs, they get off of all these other programs and they bring money into the coffers. I know you guys have seen this research. And it's just another piece of it. It shouldn't be our whole focus, but it's a piece of the economic thing. If you're not going to approach it from humanity's sake, approach it for the economic sake, that this really does make our country and our state stronger economically, to to change the trajectory of these families. And every single one of them changes with education. That's the number one factor every time. So it isn't a human services program. It's the education that changes it. So is it worth putting that into the economic calculations that we can celebrate?
You know what's interesting is in, and I know this from my prior employment, DWS, the performance-based funding, one portion of it, the dollar amount, the way that it's calculated, is an estimation of the tax revenue that's generated from educating the workforce. So DWS, they look at, okay, here are the occupations that are these high-paying occupations, and look at how they've grown over this past year, and how many have grown, as in how many got filled. We will assume that the filling of those positions happened because there were graduates who got educated in those fields and then got those jobs, and then they estimate the taxes that are being paid by those workers, and that becomes a number, but it's happening in the background. Yeah. Perhaps we could bring it to the foreground as something that we're touting, there's an estimated X percent increase in the taxable income in our state that happened because people got jobs.
Yeah.
And then you're adding the component of perhaps even some of these people were once taking, or they were getting the transfer payments from the tax system. They're no longer taking transfer payments, and they're adding to the revenue.
Yeah.
I'm glad Woodford wasn't here to hear your comment about building roads.
She knows how to read the room.
Yeah. I worked with UDOT. They would get savings and then tell the governor to put it in human services. UDOT was wonderful. They were always like, how much money can we get? I support roads too.
Well, these were excellent comments. Any others, Alan?
No, thank you. I'm really pleased with what I see this committee's doing and this great team that's working behind the scenes to make it happen.
Yeah.
I would ask you the question of what would you like us to do differently? How would you like to use us? How might we be more helpful? And if you had a big vision of where we need to take it, what is it that you have? I have sort of one in my mind, but I'd love to be educated by you on what you see the future should look like.
I hope Blair's not uncomfortable with me putting him on the spot. He has more experience on what we can do, what potential we have, and I want to maybe turn over to him to see what his thoughts are on.
So thank you. That's a great question. I appreciate that question as well, Regional Hall. But starting out from workforce, I think many of you know that there's a lot of work that is done to try to align workforce with education. The institutions do that as they design their programs. There's structures in place. We have organized CTE efforts across the state to get the right occupational training. We've got initiatives that are designed to link new higher ed programs into the workforce. There's Talent Ready Utah, there's strategic workforce investment, there's the engineering initiative, which alone has made a huge effort just to we have the right computer technicians and scientists and engineers going out into our local labor market. But and as far as the Regent work on this effort has been phenomenal as well. Much of the work was done in the ASA committee, along with a whole bunch of other things. I really relish the opportunity to work with a targeted group of regents that are really kind of singularly focused on workforce. We're not really, from my perspective anyway, I don't think we're really starting this from scratch. I mentioned some of the programs that we have already and some of the work the institutions are doing. But about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, the regents were charged to develop a task force or a working group centered on workforce. I don't know that anybody on this group was part of that. But that group worked for about 6 months to develop kind of some groundwork that then fed into
some strategic initiatives that sort of, frankly, sort of got a lot of the work of that committee didn't really make it to prime time. Some of it did, but a lot of it didn't. But I think maybe as a starting point, Carrie and I could kind of work on looking at what that group did and some of the recommendations from that group. You know, I could spout some of those off right now, but it might be premature at this point. But we're coming to this with some perspective, but we really would value your fresh look at it as well. So, and what can we do to really move the needle toward alignment, toward helping and supporting the institutions in getting the programs that they need and getting those programs really tailored and targeted even more so to industry and you know, just kind of take it from where we are and help us steer this ship a little bit more intentionally.
Well, I'd like us to embrace Blair's challenge and kind of be thinking about that. And when we meet next month, that would be a good item for us to talk about of how we can move that forward. So appreciate that. So this kind of covers up all of our action item and our two information items. We have one other assignment, and that is to appoint two members of this committee to the scholarship committee. And I would like to appoint Lisa Michelle Church and Alan Hall. They both jumped in with comments this morning, so we know they would be engaged, and I'd like to ask them to represent us on that scholarship committee and keep us informed of what's happening there. Appreciate your willingness to do that. So I think we can adjourn, and we have 3 minutes to get into the committee of the whole.
Can I use one of those minutes?
Yes, please, Marlon.
You know, I'm very excited to be a part of this committee with all of you. I'm a believer in data. But in a previous life where I worked as a poor preacher trying to change human behavior, I learned that there are a lot of things, in fact, maybe the most significant changes that can come about in a person's life are very difficult to measure. And so as data-driven as we're going to be and as anxious as we are to align with the workforce, I hope we'll keep ever in our mind, in our advocacy and otherwise, that for me at least, the real value of education hasn't been money. And maybe that's because I was born privileged like most of you have been. Moving a needle in someone's life when they have a greater vision, when they are born with greater integrity, when some of these non-measurable qualities can be brought into existence, and when a person then can engage in our world, can have some sense of civic responsibility and so on. I think we can't ever forget that, at least in my opinion, half the good of education belongs in that bailiwick, and that we've got to, our work has to be designed, I think, to bring about both of those outcomes.
Yeah.
A livable wage and a livable life.
Mm-hmm.
I might say it that way.
Well said.
Yeah. Yeah. A better life.
Thanks for having that perspective.
Thank you. Those were very appropriate. Okay, well then you're all excused to go back to Committee of the Whole.
Thank you.
Well, good. Okay, let's figure out. Oh, man.
Yeah, send me a note now.
If we were there this morning, they talked about who's on the COVID.